So take a moment and recall the benefits of bodhicitta, like Shantideva explained to us in the preceding chapter. And then contemplating those benefits briefly, generate the bodhicitta in your mind. And be aware of how bodhicitta enables you to become the kind of person that you want to become. That there's nothing deleterious about bodhicitta. And so in that way, see how generating bodhicitta enables you to work for the purpose of others by attaining full awakening and being able to guide them, and how you can also fulfill your own purpose by generating bodhicitta, because it will enable you to purify your mind completely of all the obscurations. So this idea that something in our spiritual practice can fulfill the purpose of others and fulfill our own purpose at the same time is something we may have to get used to, because often it happens, if we were trained in another religion beforehand, that we have the idea that we're only being compassionate and working for others' welfare when we neglect ourselves or we sacrifice in a painful way for ourselves. Whereas in Buddhism, benefiting others and benefiting ourselves comes to the same point. Yeah, but the whole idea of what it means to benefit ourselves in Buddhism is very different from our worldly idea of benefiting ourselves. Because our worldly idea is, can I have money and power and status and, you know, youth and this and that, all sorts of worldly things. In Buddhism, you know, fulfilling our own purpose involves purifying our mind, developing the Buddha's qualities, being able to have completely equanimous and impartial love and compassion for all beings. Okay, so it doesn't involve any kind, the goal is not some kind of painful thing. Okay, now it does happen that, you know, in order to follow the path, we have to challenge our self-centeredness, and that can sometimes be quite uncomfortable, you know, and our mind can sometimes rage against that. But If we can get over that, you know, then we really see that transforming our mind and having our mind progress towards full awakening actually is the path to happiness for ourselves, you know, as well as the path to happiness for all living beings. Okay, that's important to keep in mind. I think we're starting on verse 21 or 22 of chapter 2. So in chapter 1 of the text, Guide to Engaging in the Bodhisattva's Deeds, Shenji Deva, the author, spoke about the benefits of bodhicitta. And in this chapter, chapter 2, he's going over some of the preparatory practices to help us purify our mind and enrich it with merit so that we can take the bodhisattva vow, which comes in the following chapter, and then engage in the bodhisattva deeds, which come in the chapters after that. Okay, so we're already partway through this chapter. The beginning part talked about prostration and, imagining the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and ourselves with numerous bodies, you know, bowing. And we call prostrations, you know, there's three types that, so we usually think of them as a physical act, but that's only one of the three kinds of prostration, you know, bowing our body. Then there's the verbal prostration, which is saying a praise to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And then the mental prostration, which is visualizing them in the space before us and generating a sense of trust in them and confidence in them. Okay, so don't just think of prostrations as a substitute for going to the gym. It's not. There's a whole meditation practice that lies behind it. Okay, and then Shanti Deva started to talk about making offerings. And so we got into this big thing about the offering bath to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and how this actually symbolizes cleansing our own Buddha nature, cleansing our own mind stream of defilements and negativities and non-virtue, you know, the seeds of non-virtuous karmas and all. Okay. So I'm just going to start with verse 21, you know, it's also about offerings, and then that'll keep us going. And may a continuous rain of flowers and precious gems descend upon the reliquaries and the statues and upon all the jewels of Dharma. Okay, so here we're making offerings to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and the Dharma by making offerings to the representations. Okay, so the statues represent the Buddha, specifically the Buddha's body. The reliquaries or the stupas represent the Buddha's mind. And the Dharma texts represent the Buddha's speech. Okay, and so we think of all the statues and paintings and so on representing the Buddha, and we make offerings to these. This is what we usually do when we go to a Buddhist center because there aren't, you know, we don't know of real Buddhas being there. But they say, think of the statues and the physical images as if they were, actual Buddhas because they're the representations. Personally speaking, I find it more helpful to focus on the visualization and think that I'm in a pure land with living Buddhas and invoke those Buddhas there and then make the offerings and bowing, thinking that, you know, there's real Buddhas there, because otherwise I tend to think, oh, there's a stupa or a statue and it's not a real Buddha, even though, you know, we try and see it as a representation of one. Okay, so I think different people may have different ways of seeing this kind of thing. People from a Jewish background or a Muslim background are not going, you know, they may not want to bow to Buddha, statues of the Buddha, because in their own religion, when they grew up, you don't do that. Yeah, the idea of God is ineffable and can't be expressed in a physical form. Whereas people who were brought up Christians, you know, to do something before a painting or a statue is quite natural, because you had, you know, Jesus on the cross or a cross or, you know, images of the different saints. And so that feels comfortable to them. So I think, you know, we have to do what feels comfortable to us. Yeah. I remember one time I was teaching, leading a retreat in a kibbutz in Israel. And the people there were from a Buddhist group, so they were used to bowing to statues and paintings and so on. But the people who lived in the kibbutz, who were not Buddhist, they asked me to give a talk one evening. And then, so I spoke a little bit, but actually one woman, I remember, raised her hand very quickly and said, "But you people worship idols. You know, I saw that meditation room and you were bowing to the Buddha, and the Buddha is just a human being, you know, and he has sexual organs, and how can you bow to a statue and a human being, you know, because, you know, something holy should be beyond the human body." Yeah. So, of course, you know, when we talk about the Buddha's body, it is beyond the human body. Okay. It isn't made of flesh and blood. It's not born out of ignorance and so on. Okay. So, you know, in that way, Buddhism agrees with what she was saying. But, you know, the physical representation really pushed this lady's buttons. So I explained to her that, you know, each religion has its own way of doing physical representations that remind us of the divine. And in Judaism and Islam, you don't have a human form. You know, it's too tied to being a defiled human being, yeah? Which we can certainly understand, yeah? But then I said to her, because, you know, in Jerusalem, people come from all over the world, and the Jews, anyway, will go to the Wailing Wall and pray at the wall, because the wall is the last remnant of the ancient temple that was destroyed thousands of years ago, that threw the Jews into diaspora. And so you'll see people at the wall, you know, facing the wall a few inches in front of it and reciting their prayers and rocking back and forth. That's what you do, you know, when you recite your prayers. And you know, and then write their prayers sometimes and put them in the holes in the rocks, you know, the bricks that form the wall. His Holiness went to the Wailing Wall. Yeah. And it was very cute. He wore a yarmulke when he went. Yeah. He didn't have problems with any of this stuff. So I explained to that woman, you know, who objected about the Buddhist statues and people worshiping them. I said, you know, when people from Tibet who are not Buddhists, who are not Jews, see people praying in front of a wall, they think the people are worshiping a wall. And why in the world would you worship a wall? Okay. So it's equivalent to worshiping a statue. It's a physical form. And then I hope, I don't know if she got the point, that, you know, we use representations of the holy to invoke our faith and our inspiration, but we aren't actually worshiping those physical items. Yeah. But it was an interesting interaction. And it was also very funny when in 1990, there was a Jewish delegation that went to Dharamsala to dialogue with His Holiness. And on Friday night, you know, they had it's a big dinner. You're welcoming in the Shabbos. So you have a dinner and you do prayers. And they invited the Tibetan Geshe's and Rinpoches, some of them in Dharamsala, to come. Okay. So the idea is, because the day starts at sunset, so as the sun is setting, then you do your prayers to welcome in the Sabbath. And so the Jews, the way the place they were staying was arranged is they were facing west, because you face towards Jerusalem. And so the sun, the place was high up, and the sun was setting in the background, and they were facing the west and worshiping, you know, praying towards Jerusalem. And so, you know, they're chanting and the whole thing that they're doing. And then the Tibetan Geshe's said afterwards, were those people worshiping the sun? You know, because that's what it looked like. The sun is out there. And we had to explain, no, they don't worship the sun, because from a Buddhist view, it's only, you know, these really other people who worship the sun. But the point is, when we don't understand the meaning of something, it's very easy for us to judge. Yeah. So it's always better to ask questions first before forming opinions. Okay. Then verse 22, just as Manjushri and so forth made offerings to the conquerors, I make offerings in the same way to the Tathagata's protectors and their children. Okay, so here we're thinking of the great bodhisattvas, Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, Samantabhadra, who is... he's very famous for his ability to make offerings, because he would start with one Samantabhadra body, and then if you're going to do it like he used to do it, then from that one body come seven. And then from each one of those seven come seven more, so then you have 49. And then from each of the 49 come seven more, until the whole... sky is filled with Samantabhadras who are, you know, making offerings. So sometimes they say it's Samantabhadras that are on the tip of each of these light rays emanating, or you can say it starts with one Samantabhadra and then it's he emanates seven offerings, and then you have the multiplication of the offerings who are that are going throughout space. Okay, so we're saying we want to be like these great bodhisattvas and make offerings. That fill all of space. Why do we want to make offerings? Because it creates merit. Yeah, clearly the Buddhas and bodhisattvas do not need our offerings. Okay, but let's see what we gave them today. An apple and a tangerine and a cup of hot water and some cold water, some fake flowers. Those are real flowers. Yeah, we made offerings. Clearly, they don't need those, do they? You know, I mean, if you're an enlightened being, what do you need with an apple and an orange and some roses? Yeah, but the whole idea is that it opens our heart. It expands our heart to be more generous, okay? So we need that expansion. I don't know about you, but I need that expansion because it's so easy to think if I give, then I won't have. Yeah, so better to keep for myself. And then that just creates a mind of miserliness, and which is a tight mind, yeah. So the whole idea of making offerings to the Buddhas is it helps us release that tight mind. And then because the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are realized beings, you know, they are a field of merit that, you know, because, by the power of their realizations, anything we do to benefit them or to show our respect for them creates more powerful karma than if we were to benefit, you know, putting out sugar for the ants or whatever. Okay, then verse 23 is verbal praise. Okay, I glorify the oceans of excellence with limitless verses of harmonious praise. May these clouds of gentle eulogy constantly ascend to their presence. Okay, so here we are noticing the good qualities of the objects of refuge, paying homage to them, praising them. Okay, again, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas do not need our praise. They do not have that ego problem. Yeah, they're, if we write cards thanking them for their beautiful teachings, they aren't going to put their cards on a bulletin board so that they can look at them often and remember how many people think that they're great. Okay, so they don't have this problem like we do. Okay. Okay, so we're expressing our regard for them in a verbal way. And it's, we have to remember when we do this that it should be beautiful. Okay? So when we chant as a group, we have to learn to listen to each other and stay on tune instead of just singing, chanting at our own pitch without paying attention to others' pitch or paying attention to the speed with which others are chanting. So, you know, if you pay attention to that and if you notice that things are off kilter, what I do is I stop chanting because I don't want to add to it. I let the chant leader's voice, you know, I want their voice to come through, and then everybody can follow the chant leader's voice, which is why we need to make sure that who's ever leading the chant, everybody can hear that. Okay. So especially after lunch, you know, making sure sometimes when it's just the mic that is hooked on here, you can't necessarily hear people throughout the room. Yeah, so we should really, you know, think our offering should be something beautiful. Otherwise, if we're all chanting, you know, Namo Bhagavate, you know, then the Buddha is gonna like, oh, forget it. I don't want to listen to this. Yeah. So when we chant, we are invoking the presence of the Buddhas. It should be melodious. It should be an offering. So train yourself to listen to what the group is doing and checking if your voice is harmonizing with it. If it isn't, either because your voice is off or because the whole group is off, then pause, you know, and let's let the group balance and let's let the leader's voice be the anchor that we all follow. Okay. Can you just imagine there's going to be one Buddha statue like this? You know, it's like, get these, they mean well, but get them away. Okay, then verse 24 is a physical homage. And it reads, with bodies as numerous as all the atoms within the universe, I prostrate to all the Buddhas of the three times, the Dharma and the Supreme Community. Okay, so here we imagine that we have multiple bodies, again, that fill the universe. One way to think of it is that it's all your previous life's bodies, but they're in human form. Or you can just imagine yourself emanating many human bodies, okay? So you don't think of the visualizing your previous cat's rebirth, bowing to the Buddha and so on. We transform all of our previous rebirths, imagine them as human bodies. And then if we can bow physically, we do that, you know, with the full body. If we can't, then we put our palms together. We tuck our thumbs in. That represents that we're offering a jewel, particularly the jewel of our Buddha nature. And be sure, that back here, your palms are touching and they're as flat as they can, and we want to hold them up here. I still see people, their hands are like this or like this. So really be mindful of how you hold your hands. Okay. The Tibetans are not so careful with that, but the Chinese are. And so because we follow the Vinaya tradition from Taiwan, I think it's good if we do like that. Otherwise, Venerable Wu Yin is going to come here and look at us. And then Venerable Jenker is going to come to me and say, tell them how to hold their hands when they bow. How long have they been ordained? And then I have to think of some excuse. Like, I taught them, but they just don't follow. Yeah. Americans are very individual-minded, you know? It's like this whole thing with wearing masks now. Somebody tells you to wear a mask. No! No. Well, it'll help protect you and protect other people. I don't care. I don't want to do what you tell me to. Why not? Because you told me to do it. Yeah? Okay. Okay. Then verse 25. Okay. It reads, likewise, I prostrate to all the reliquaries, to the bases of bodhicitta, to the learned abbots and masters, and to all the noble practitioners. Okay, so here we're bowing to the three baskets of teachings, especially in the Mahayana canon. So the Vinaya, the sutras and the Abhidharma were, these are all, in the first two lines, we're bowing to the basis for generating bodhicitta, you know, so the scriptures for the people who are going to teach us bodhicitta, for the place where it's generated, for the body of the Buddha, for stupas that represent the Buddha's mind, okay? And so those symbols, and then also to think of our abbots and our preceptors, our Dharma teachers, and so on, okay? And to all the people who are really excellent practitioners. So showing our respect towards all of them. Okay. Again, these people do not need our respect. You know, if you're an excellent practitioner, you don't need this kind of thing. But from our side, the more we can see others' good qualities and show respect to their good qualities, then the easier it becomes for us to generate those good qualities. Whereas if we see people with good qualities and we're jealous of them and we don't want them to have the esteem or the offerings that they get because of their good qualities, then we're generating negative karma by being jealous, aren't we? And when you look at the first bodhisattva precept, root vow, it's praising oneself and criticizing others out of attachment to respect and offerings. Yeah, so it's a very heavy thing, and it really turns us away from the path, because then we're making the path, you know, how we make everything. It's a competition, and we've got to be better than other people, and when we're better, then society has to recognize us. And if they don't recognize us, we're not being treated fairly, and we don't have our self-confidence. And, you know, all this very ordinary way of thinking comes in very easily. Yeah. So it's something to really take care with and to think about the benefits of showing respect to those who are worthy of respect. Yeah. And you see it. I mean, when we watch our teachers, how they respect their teachers. Yeah. And especially how people show respect to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. It's, you know, you can really see it's not just formality. It's with a real sense of respect and gratitude.
One thing I noticed in the commentary on, I think it was this verse, pretty sure, and also in the 108 verses of Great Compassion, is they talk about the burden of the bodhisattvas, or the burden of the abbots, or the burden of the preceptors of training us. And I think that, I don't know, I just was struck when I first saw that, but I'm not sure if they're writing it for us who are aspiring and dealing with burdens, or who they're writing that for.
I think they're writing it, and it comes in Vinaya too, you know, training somebody. I think it's done to remind us that of the kindness that and the effort that people are extending to help us. And not to take that for granted. Yeah. And when you think of it sometimes, you know, when I would think of how my first teachers were, yeah, just as an example, I mean, they came, I met them in America. I didn't meet them in Asia. And I thought of, you know, here are these people, they're refugees from their own country, yeah, not so many years out of their own country, living in very poor conditions in their, in exile, trying to reestablish their own monasteries in exile, and they take the time out from that to come teach people in the West. Yeah. And people in the West have no idea who these Tibetan lamas are. And, you know, they're just kind of objects of fascination. And you know, people come and throw their arms around them and hug them. They have no idea how to treat monastics. They have no idea of making offerings. You know, they say, oh, they're teaching for free. That's great, you know, and never think of the teachers having expenses that they need to meet and so on. And then the behavior being totally disrespectful. Yeah. I mean, in some of these beginning classes, and I've, you know, taught a number of them and been present with my bad behavior at some of them too, is, you know, people lying down in the middle of teachings. Yeah. Teachers trying to teach us the path to enlightenment. But you feel tired, so you lie down. Stretch your legs out. Sometimes you stretch your legs out to the teacher. I'm not exaggerating. Or people lie down with their legs stretched out and their hand like this. You know? Or they bring their knees up and put their hands on it and kind of look like this. Or they look through a book. Or nowadays they take out, you know, their cell phones and, you know, they're checking on this and that. And, you know, I don't know what they're doing while the teacher's teaching. And talking to their neighbors and whispering to each other. You know, because I've had situations where I've had to say to people, I've learned how to do it politely. You know, those of you who are having a conversation, it's really difficult for me to give a talk when I hear other people talking. It becomes very distracting for me. So please, would you help me by saving your conversation for after the Dharma talk? Yeah? So you have to, you know, you say it that way. Or, you know, please sit up straight. It makes it easier for me as a teacher so I can look at your face straight on instead of like this. So, you know, kind of having to explain things to people about some of this basic stuff. So anyway, my point is here, when I think of what my teachers gave up to come to the West and teach us, you know, we people who don't know anything about who they are, who are very disrespectful, who, you know, and people walking in and out of teachings all the time, you know, at the new courses, in and out, going out and getting their cup of coffee and bringing it in and slurping in the middle of teachings. And, you know, you name it, it is happening. Passing notes to each other, you know, flirting, you know, people flirt during teachings. And I think, you know, my teachers could have been at their monastery teaching people who are really serious about learning, yeah, and know how to behave properly and who want to learn. And they give that up to take an international airplane ride, which for myself, I do not relish when I have to take international plane rides. They take those rides, come over here. They're completely jet lagged. You know, they know just a few people. They're counting on those people to organize the whole thing. And then they meet all these other people who, you know, walk in and out and snore and flirt and everything during teaching. And, you know, and when I think about that, you know, then it really makes me appreciate what my teachers have done. Yeah. And what they've given up to be able, you know, out of compassion for people in a barbarian country. Yeah. And, you know, this is from a Buddhist viewpoint, a barbarian country. And from an ordinary viewpoint, it's becoming more like a barbarian country in recent years too. Okay, so then verse 26. So now we're going into refuge, okay, taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay. So with so this is 26. I seek what refuge in all the Buddhas until I possess the essence of awakening. I seek refuge in the Dharma and in the assembly of Bodhisattvas. Okay. So this is taking refuge. We could spend quite a long time on this part of it. I'll go through a few things briefly, and then I thought from volume 4, Following in the Buddha's Footsteps, I'll talk a little bit from the chapter on refuge there, but not very much because it'll wind up being too long. Okay, so when we're talking about the three jewels of refuge, we have the Buddha, the fully awakened one, the Dharma. The Dharma is the true paths and true cessations. Okay? So it's states of mind. That's what we're taking refuge in when we take refuge in the Dharma jewel. And then the Sangha consists of Aryas, you know, everybody who's realized emptiness directly. In the Mahayana way, you really emphasize the assembly of Arya Bodhisattvas. But in a more general way, it includes the Shravakas, the solitary realizers. Okay? So we can talk about the causal refuge and the resultant refuge. When we take refuge, we, you know, as limited beings, okay, we want to be, we have a spiritual aspiration. And so we take refuge in the external Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, which is called the causal refuge, because by following their instructions and making offerings and creating merit and so on in relationship to them, then we will learn the teachings that we put into practice and that bring the realizations. Okay, so they're the causal refuge because they're the ones who are acting as the cause of us, teaching us so that we can attain the results. Yeah, and then the resultant refuge is the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that we will become in the future. So this entails having some self-confidence, because if we don't believe that we can attain Buddhahood or even become a bodhisattva, then it's difficult to take refuge in the resultant refuge, the three jewels that we will become. But if we can, think of that I have this potential, I can do this, and that the resultant refuge, that's the one that really protects me. Yeah, the causal refuge is teaching me how to protect myself by teaching me the Dharma. At the resultant refuge, I have become the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and therefore I am, my own mind is protecting me from all defilements, the afflictive obscurations and the cognitive obscurations. Okay? So we take refuge in both of those. Is that clear to you, the difference between them? Yeah? So it's very nice to think about, the future Buddha I'm going to become. I mean, we have to take refuge in that because that's who we want to become. Yeah? It's not like I'm going to take refuge in how I look right now, but say it's a Buddha. It's like we have to think of ourselves as attaining the four Buddha bodies and having all those qualities and taking refuge in that. Okay, then, okay, I want to call up a different text here. What I thought to do is explain about the final and provisional refuge, or the final and conventional, or ultimate and conventional refuge that's spoken of in Gyulama, by Maitreya. So let me call that up here. Those of you who have volume 4 following in the Buddha's footsteps, it's it's on page 28. So the sublime continuum talks about the ultimate or the final refuge, and then the provisional or conventional refuge. Okay, so the division into final and provisional refuge is made to guide and encourage us to go towards the final goal. Okay, so all the final objects of refuge, or put it this way, a final object of refuge is a refuge that has completely traversed the entire path. So final object of refuge has completed, it's gone as far as is possible, it's reached the final goal. Whereas a provisional object of refuge has not completely traversed the whole path. It's done part of the path. Okay. So the final refuge is the final destination that we aim to attain by following the path, whereas the provisional refuge helps us get to that final refuge, the final destination. Okay, so in this light, the final refuge is the Buddha having four Buddha bodies. Okay, that's the final refuge. So to review the four bodies of the Buddha, well, first of all, we start with two, the truth body and the form body. Each one of those has two divisions. So with the truth body, there's the nature truth body, which is the emptiness and true cessations in a mind stream of the Buddha. And the wisdom truth body, which is the omniscient mind of the Buddha. Okay. With the form body, there's two of those, the enjoyment body. So that's the body that a Buddha manifests in to guide the Arya Bodhisattvas in a pure land. And then the emanation bodies that are forms that the Buddha takes to relate to us ordinary beings. Okay, so when we're talking about the final refuge, yeah, for the Buddha, you know, it's all four bodies, okay? Then when we talk about the realized Dharma, okay, so we talk about the transmitted Dharma and the realized Dharma. So the transmitted Dharma are the spoken words and the scriptures of the Dharma, and the realized Dharma are the realizations in someone's mind stream. And it includes true paths and true cessation. Okay. And so these exist only in the mind stream of Aryas who have realized emptiness directly. But not all the realized Dharma is a final Dharma refuge, okay? Because the true paths and true cessations in an Arya's mind stream, if that Arya is not yet a Buddha, they are not complete. They're not totally purified of all the defilements. So only the realized Dharma in the mind stream of a Buddha is a final refuge. Okay. The true paths and true cessations in the mind stream of the other Aryas, those are considered a provisional refuge. Okay. Now we might say, oh, provisional makes them sound like they're not so good. And those people have realized emptiness directly. It's really wonderful what they've done. So that's true, but they still have more of the path to practice and to actualize. Okay? So with the realized Dharma, okay? So the reason why that the true paths in the mind stream of Arya learners, learners mean they aren't Buddhists yet. Why they are not the final objects of refuge and that why they're provisional refuge is because the pristine wisdom in the mind streams of those Arya learners still has a deceptive nature. Now you're going to go, what? But they've realized reality. How is it a deceptive nature? Okay. So here, deceptive has a particular meaning. It's not the usual meaning. So it's deceptive in the sense that the path appears to them to be completely free of defilements, although it is not. Okay, so this pristine wisdom directly realizes emptiness. And when it's directly realizing emptiness, it at that time is completely free from all the influence of the pollutants of ignorance and the seeds of karma. Okay, because only emptiness appears to that mind, no dualistic appearances come to Aryas who are in meditative equipoise. So from that aspect, you know, it looks, their Dharma realizations look pure. However, this pristine wisdom is not completely free from the pollutants of the latencies of ignorance and still possesses the defilements which are included in cognitive obscurations. Okay. So they've done a lot of work. It's fantastic. But because they haven't reached the ultimate end of the path, their realizations, their, you know, realized Dharma is considered a provisional refuge. Similarly, the true cessations in the mind streams of these Aryas, Arya learners, is provisional realized Dharma because they don't have all of the true cessations. Okay. And then similarly, the true cessations in the mind streams of the Shravaka and solitary realizers, learners, they aren't the final refuge. They're provisional. So that's both the paths and the true cessations that they have. Okay. So what this categorizing is doing is pointing us that the really supreme goal of our practice is a Buddha with all the qualities of a fully awakened one, you know, whose mind is totally purified. So we're not dismissing the achievements of the Arya Sangha, but this text is designed to steer us all the way, okay? So then in terms of the transmitted or the scriptural Dharma that is made of letters, words, phrases, sentences, you know, that explains the actual realized Dharma, Okay. So with the exception of the transmitted Dharma in the mind stream of a Buddha, all the other words and so on, reciting the Dharma, teaching the scriptures, that's also a provisional refuge. Okay. Because only when the Buddha is saying the words are those words completely purified of all obscurations. Okay. Now, this doesn't deny the fact that the words of the Aryas is going to be very potent, because whenever we're able to hear the teachings from somebody who has realizations, the teachings are going to be more potent and they're really going to go into our heart because that person's speaking from experience. Okay? So we still esteem and value the teachings of the Aryas. Yeah? And even of ordinary beings, because somehow we have to encounter the Dharma. But in terms of where we want to make our ultimate aim, we want to always steer it towards Buddhahood. Okay. And then similarly, when we think of the Sangha, okay, the actual final Sangha, that's the final object of refuge, are Arya Buddhas. When we say the term Arya Buddha, it refers to a person who is a Buddha, okay? Because just the word Buddha can include things that are qualities of Buddhas that are not persons. Okay? We went through that in Precious Garland, remember? The difference between Buddha and Arya Buddha. Okay, so, Okay, so in terms of the final object of refuge, it's the four Buddha bodies. That's for the Buddha refuge. For the Dharma refuge, it's the true cessations and true paths in the mind stream of an Arya Buddha. And for the Sangha refuge, it is an Arya Buddha. For the provisional object of refuge, for the Buddha, there's no provisional because everything is final. Okay. For the provisional Dharma refuge, it's the true paths and true cessations in the mind streams of Arya learners. And for the Sangha refuge, it's Arya learners themselves. Okay. Then we can also sometimes talk about the symbolic three, you know, then there's talk of the actual three jewels, which I haven't gone into because that would take a long time. But we also talk of the symbolic jewels, what symbolizes the three jewels. So for the Buddha, it would be statues, paintings, things like that. That's the symbolic jewel. For the Dharma, it's the transmitted Dharma, especially the scriptures, with the exception of when the Buddha is reciting them, because that would make it final Dharma. And so that transmitted Dharma, the scriptures and so forth, symbolizes the Dharma jewel. And then for the Sangha jewel, what symbolizes it is the assembly of ordinary Sangha members. So at least four fully ordained monks, four fully ordained nuns. And that becomes a symbol of the Arya Sangha. So that shows very clearly, you know, how the word Sangha should be used. Because in the West now, the word Sangha is often used for anybody who goes to a Buddhist center. And that's very, very confusing for people. So in the traditional way, and there's a reason to follow the traditional teachings. We should follow the traditional meaning.
Just to clarify, this pristine wisdom that's not free of pollutants and latencies, we're talking about bodhisattvas all the way up to like the upper ground of the eighth ground? I mean, we're talking just before cognitive obscurations are removed?
When we're talking about the final refuge, we're going beyond. The final refuge has remove both levels of obscurations. Okay? And so the first level of obscurations, the afflictive obscurations, those are removed by arhats in the Shravaka and solitary realizer vehicle. And they're removed by the eighth ground of bodhisattvas. So the eighth, ninth, and tenth bodhisattva ground, they're called the pure grounds because they're pure of the afflictive obscurations. But those bodhisattvas still have the cognitive obscurations, so they aren't the final refuge.
The provisional.
Yeah.
Provisional refuge.
Yeah, they're still provisional. Because to be final, you have to remove both obscurations. And the eighth ground bodhisattvas haven't done that. Yeah. What they have done and the powers of the eighth ground bodhisattvas is tremendous. When you read volume 6, okay, which should be, which is with the editor now. I sent it in, the final version, last week, or the week before. Anyway, there that we put in many quotations from the Sutra of the Ten Grounds that talk about the qualities and abilities of the bodhisattvas as they go higher and higher. And the pure ground bodhisattvas is just tremendous. I mean, even the first ground bodhisattvas, even the bodhisattvas that are ordinary beings on the first and second path, the path of accumulation, path of preparation, you know, their abilities are still quite wonderful.
That's why they're all called learners, because they're all doing this,
yeah,
removing, eliminating.
They're still learning.
Learning.
They're still learning.
Until the path of no more learning.
Yes. Yeah.
Is provisional refuge and conventional refuge the same thing, or are they different meanings? Like, ultimate refuge, conventional refuge, and then provisional refuge. Is provisional and conventional, do they mean the same thing?
Pretty much. That we ran into in the Sublime Continuum. It's not totally clear. Some teachers say it's the same. Some teachers seem to think that there may be some difference. So that is on the question list. Yeah.
Someone online says that, I read in some books, I take refuge in the gurus, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Why the gurus if the jewels are three?
Okay. Yeah, this question comes up a lot. So it's because if you are headed, if your ultimate aim is to practice the Tantra, yeah, in the Tantra teachings, the guru is said to embody all three refuges. Okay? So you could, yeah. The guru embodies all three refuges. And the guru is very important in the Tantra tradition. In a way, the guru is important all through Buddhism. But in Tantra, it's especially important. And in a very special way that, you know, is not present when you're talking about your Vinaya guru or your Bodhisattva teachings guru. Okay? So it's because the guru is seen to embody all the realizations of the three jewels that the guru is included when you take refuge. But there's still only three jewels. The guru is not a separate object of refuge. It's the embodiment of the three. Okay.
Another question. What should we do with the food offerings? Take them and eat them after some time? Sorry for this maybe naive question.
It's a good question. Everybody asks it at the beginning. Okay. So Usually you take them down on the day that you offer them. You may leave them sometimes up another day, but usually you make the offering in the morning. You take it down in the evening. Mentally, it's good to see yourself as the custodian of the Buddha's offerings. Yeah. And so you're helping to take care of them when you take them down. So in terms of the food offerings, you can give them to other people or you can eat them yourself. In terms of the water offerings, like in the water bowl offerings, those you usually put out on growing plants. Okay. You don't flush it down the toilet, put it out with plants or something. Flowers sometimes are left up for a couple of days, but when they start to wilt, you should take them down. Don't wait until they're fully wilted. Okay. Just when they start to grow brown, you want to take them down. And then those you also put somewhere outside in nature. You know, sometimes if you're living in a city, it's not so easy to put these things outside. Yeah. So sometimes you save them and then you find some bushes to put them under or whatever. Or what I do sometimes is I'll just wrap them in paper or something and then put them in the regular trash because there's no place else to put them. Okay. Yeah. I mean, some cities you can't, there's not even enough greenery to put the flowers outside to decompose.
And someone asks, are the guru and the teacher in Tantra the same?
Yeah, your tantric teacher is your tantra guru. And that's the person who gives you the empowerment. Okay. And you want to be well-versed in the general Buddha's teachings before you take an empowerment.
Yeah. They're coming in.
Good.
So someone in Morocco asks, if I want to take refuge officially, could I do that only by myself or do I need a guru to guide the ritual?
You usually need somebody to do the ritual ceremony for you. The real refuge is in your heart and you don't need anybody to do that for you. So the real refuge is your own feeling in your heart. If you want to take the refuge ceremony, then somebody does that. It's usually a Sangha member and, you know, or usually one of your teachers can do that. And when you do that, you can also take some or all of the five precepts, the five lay precepts, to abandon killing, stealing, unwise and unkind sexual behavior, lying and taking intoxicants. So it's been asked, since we are in the COVID area and everything is changed, some people have requested to take refuge and precepts online because there's no way for them to get here. So the Abbey has a packet of materials that we send to people who are interested in taking refuge and precepts. So there's materials to read so that you understand what you're doing, and then questions to contemplate and write out. And then we review those. And then when there's several people who it seems, you know, are prepared to take refuge and precepts, and there's no possible way for them to come here, then we'll do an online refuge and precept ceremony.
To go back to the question about the food offerings, he says, when we say that we should offer the first bite of food to the Buddha, how do we do that in practice?
Oh, it's just to imagine you don't put it in your mouth and take it out and put it in the altar. Not like that. Actually, we try and think that we offer our whole meal to the Buddha, but then you think that when you're eating, that there's a small Buddha made of light at your heart, and that you offer, you know, the bite of food, and it becomes blissful wisdom nectar, and the Buddha at your heart receives it and experiences bliss. And so we will start next, if you have Gyaltsen Jay's commentary. It would be on page 62. The way in Gyaltsen Jay's commentary, he started numbering the pages with one for every chapter. So it's very confusing when you open the PDF and you're trying to find the first page of the second chapter. So you have to look at your PDF numbers, not the page numbers on the written text.
Yeah, I was just going to close and then I realized, oh no, I had Mark something to ask you about. I think it was verse 25 where we talked about the bases.
Mm-hmm.
And then in here in the commentary, they talk about three Mahayana baskets.
Yeah.
That's strange because I didn't know that we talked about a Mahayana Vinaya basket.
Oh, we don't talk about a Mahayana Vinaya basket. I think that's true. And, you know, unless they're referring to, I mean, the Bodhisattva precepts, but usually those would come under the sutra. Unless here, you know, it's meant to be taken under the Vinaya basket. I'm not sure. Okay.